Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where does English come from? Why do we structure it differently from all its Germanic language cousins? And for that matter, why on earth do we insert that useless little do verb into so many of our questions? These are the sorts of questions that bedevil linguist John McWhorter, especially since long-accepted theories about the origins of English don't thoroughly explain its curious idiosyncrasies. McWhorter shares some of his own ideas in a new book. It's called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. John, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thank you very much.
What makes the standard history of English so, to use your word, vanilla?
Well, the basic idea is that English, Old English, what we now know it as, was brought over the North Sea to England in around the 400s AD. And what made the difference between that language and our language is a whole big bunch of words. And so Scandinavian Vikings lent a whole big bunch of words, then the French, and then there was Latin. And so we've got this big, fat vocabulary that was not there before, and we're taught that our language is uniquely receptive to words, which actually it's not. And then that's just it. Now, we know, or those of us who have had any exposure to Old English know, that there's a big difference in just the grammar, the fundamentals of how words are put together between Old English and Modern English. But according to the traditional account, all that just happened by chance. It was just a kind of morphing along. And just kind of an accident. And really what's interesting about English is just that it's a big bunch of words. I have never found that terribly exciting, and that's because I'm a linguist, and linguists don't study etymology. That's not what we do. Some linguists study words for various reasons, but we're not interested in language as a word collection for the most part. We're interested in how the words are put together, what we call the grammar, not good grammar versus bad grammar, but the system of how we know what order to put words in and how we know what endings to put on and to take off. And in that sense, I find the development of English much more interesting than the fact that it's a big, fat basket of words. And so that's what Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue is about.
So how are the other Germanic languages like each other, and how is English different?
Well, the Germanic languages, depending on how you count it, are a dozen or so closely related languages. In Europe is where they arose. And they are, of course, different languages, but the ones other than English are variations on a theme. And so if anyone has ever taken German or speaks German, then they would find that if they had to learn any other Germanic language, be that Swedish or Icelandic or Afrikaans or Yiddish or what have you, that they would be working with the same game plan. There would be some effort involved, but it's the same basic thing. And so nouns come in genders, the sort of thing that we English speakers have to grapple with whenever we learn seemingly almost any other language except Chinese. English doesn't have that. It's the only Germanic language that does not have that. It's the only Indo-European language in general in Europe that doesn't have that kind of gender. Or the business with German's funny word order, with the verb going in different places, often at the end of the sentence. Variations on that are in all of the other Germanic languages. English doesn't have that, and it doesn't have so very much else that other Germanic languages have. And it hasn't added all that many things of its own. It's a very peculiar, strangely simplified, and I also think highly mixed language, and not just in its words, that's long established, but also in how to put together even the most basic of sentences.
Yeah, you call English a miscegenated language.
Yeah, this is very much a language that is a hybrid, and that is in its structure. Like, for example, what I call in the book meaningless do. You know, why do we say, do you go to the store? If it were a Germanic language or pretty much any other European language, it would be go you to the store. That's the good card-carrying European language way of making a question. Somehow we have this do, or if you are doing a negative sentence, and so, for example, I do not go to the store, why the do? That's a very peculiar thing. And traditional scholars on the history of English think that do just kind of happened. It was kind of like a fly that got caught in the screen on a hot summer day, and nobody ever bothered to scrape it away. But really, that doesn't work, because if you look at all the languages of the world, and there are 6,000 languages, if you look at all the languages of the world, and of course no one has, but my survey of this and having asked a lot of other people is such that it is reasonable to say that. There are no languages in the world that use do the way English does and has, except for the Celtic languages, which is spoken in Britain, and that includes, for our purposes, Welsh today. And so the Celtic speakers were using do in this way. Now English uses do in this way when Old English didn't. And clearly there was some sort of relationship between the two things. English picked it up from Welsh, basically. Traditional scholars of English say that the resemblance is just accidental. It isn't, and I try to make that case in Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue.
Yeah, you talk about the fact that linguists have made a series of assumptions over the years that really deserve closer scrutiny, starting with the idea that all the Celts and the people who spoke Celtic languages simply died out after being invaded.
Yep. The general idea, and I'm caricaturing only slightly, is that the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes came and something must have happened. I mean, they must have had some magnificent weapon, because here is an island that was peopled thickly by Celts. And after a certain amount of time, often thought to only have been some hundreds of years, the Celts were virtually exterminated, you know, either, you know, reduced to abject slavery in small numbers or completely admixed through marriage. And Celt land only survived on the edges in what is today, for example, Wales, or where Cornish, a related language, used to be spoken southerly of that. But it really doesn't make sense. And one of the many reasons that we know this is currently genetic analysis, or also just, how would they have killed that many people? You know, these are people a very, very long time ago. It's the 400s AD. You don't have a gun. You certainly don't have a nuclear bomb. How many people can you kill? And so there's all sorts of evidence, cultural, genetic, not to mention just logical, that the Celts hung around.
John McWhorter is my guest. He is a linguist. His new book is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. What about ing words? We use that to sort of communicate present action, as in I am speaking with John McWhorter. Is that unique?
It is not unique. A language often has a way of saying, I'm doing something right now. But what's weird about English is that if you were building yourself a house and someone walked by and asked you, you know, what are you doing, Fred? Your answer would not be, I build a house. If that was your answer, it would only be if you had an accent, like, I build a house. Then it's somebody who's non-native to English. Your answer would be, I'm building a house. Now, it's perfectly obvious that you're doing it right then, and yet we have to say that in English, whereas if you think about it in German, you would say, I build a house. In French and Spanish, I build a house. Now, if you wanted to stress it, you might say, at this very moment, I'm in the process of building a house, but that would be very explicit. English is odd in that you have to use that ing, that progressive, so much that is our basic present tense. And once again, that's the way Celtic languages of Britain are, too. And once again, we're taught that that's just an accident. I don't think it is.
One of the problems, you think, is that a lot of linguists just simply are not familiar with Celtic languages, whereas they know Germanic languages very well. Why is it that they don't know Celtic language?
Well, you know, as I said, there are 6,000 languages in the world. There are countless languages just in Europe. And the last thing I want to imply is that I speak Welsh or Cornish either. I have linguist yeoman familiarity with the basic outlines of the grammar, and that's enough to see these kinds of resemblances. But the fact is, no linguist knows all languages, and the Celtic languages are spoken by a relative few, and so there's no reason for most linguists to have any really deep familiarity with the grammar of Welsh unless they happen to be a Celticist, and that's what they study. And so it's not that people who study English have no idea that those languages are there and know nothing about them whatsoever, but I do believe that if we were in an alternate universe where the typical person had kind of schoolboy Welsh or Cornish in school, like we have French or Spanish today, then the whole issue of whether or not English had been influenced by Celtic would just be considered a slam dunk. Instead, I think the people working on the history of English, while they are, you know, brilliant people, deeply erudite, smarter than me, doing great work in itself, they don't have the Celtic grammars kind of on their brain because they just wouldn't happen to have any reason to. But when you look at the Celtic grammar, the resemblance is clearly so close and so particular, and the history is so obvious in terms of the relationship, that you can't deny that English is the way it is because of those languages.
You mentioned earlier, John, that the fact that someone who said, I build a house, would probably be a non-native speaker of English. And in fact, you think one of the reasons that English grammar might be so simple compared to the other Germanic languages is that, in fact, it was spoken by people who didn't speak it originally.
That was a beautiful transition. Yes, indeed, that's true. And so what English is it's a Germanic language that got beaten up by people learning it to a schoolboy level. And the people who did that were the Scandinavian Viking invaders who came in great numbers, married English-speaking people. And what clearly happened is that so many people were speaking a non-native English, fully communicative, but not the way the grammar had originally been, and not as complex the way a lot of us in America today speak French and Spanish, for example. So many people heard that that became the language. And so children started being affected by that way of speaking, and the English language itself became what you can think of as having started as a broken-down normal Germanic language, and now it's been streamlined into a normal language, but with a lot fewer of the bells and whistles that make a Germanic language like German.
Let's talk about how we change verb tenses in English. Of course, we have the standard ways of doing this, but then there are a lot of words where the consonants stay the same and the vowel sounds change. Run and ran, read and read, sink and sank. What other languages do that?
You know, that's an odd one, and here's where things get more speculative, because you end up going way back in time. You end up going before writing. But, yeah, you can say walk, walked. That's one way of doing the past tense. But another way is just to change the vowel, as in run, ran. And so in a way, the word is er-n, and then the vowel is what marks the tense. And this is something which is not only an English trait, but this is something that Germanic languages pick up the ball and run with. Now, if you go a step back, Germanic is a sub-branch of a larger family called Indo-European. That's most of the languages of Europe, as well as languages of India and Iran. And in Indo-European languages, there is that run-ran tendency. That's part of the whole group. But the Germanic languages really take it further than the other groups. It's very much a Germanic trait. And what's interesting is that other languages in the world that are well-known for doing that are Semitic languages, like Arabic and Hebrew. And there is indirect evidence, and I discussed this in the last chapter, and this can't be accepted as truth yet, but it's tantalizing evidence that Proto-Germanic, the original language that ended up developing into German and English and the others, was affected by speakers of a Semitic language, probably Phoenician, and that the reason that we have so much of the run, ran, think, thought sort of thing, as well as some other traits, is because Proto-Germanic got mislearned by Semitic speakers who ended up mixing their ways of doing things into the language, and then that Proto-Germanic ended up becoming all the other Germanic languages. So language development is all about mixture, and this last point is very important, on the grammatical level. And so it's not just big baskets of words, that's one story, but also just in how the very language is spoken in its very basic structural way.
I have to say, I was not expecting to come upon Phoenician at the end of this book. It was sort of exciting.
Yeah, it's weird, and that is speculative, I say. But still, it's very interesting work that's been done on that.
Why do you think there are so many orphan words in Proto-Germanic?
Well, you know, I think that that's those weirdo Phoenicians again. And I know I'm not insulting any living person by calling the Phoenicians weirdos, but they had this strange desire to travel much further than anybody had any business doing at that time. And so they came from down in the Middle East all the way up to most likely what is now Denmark. And there are about a third of the words in Proto-Germanic that don't trace back to Proto-Indo-European. So, for example, Indo-European had a word for father, and you can find developments of that word in most of the Indo-European languages today. But for some reason, about a third of the words in Proto-Germanic don't trace back to that broader ancestor, and they just seem to be out of nowhere. And what's interesting is a lot of them seem to have to do with things like fish and the sea and shipping. And so one hypothesis is that we just don't know and there's no reason for it. And I think that that hypothesis is what most traditional scholars just go for. They don't care. They don't find it interesting. And in a way, if you're studying different things, it isn't. But it could also be that Phoenician lent Proto-Germanic those words. And so there's one instance where language being a big bunch of words can be more interesting than it's often presented.
John McWhorter is with us. He is a linguist, also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His new book is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. If you want to join the conversation, get on the line now. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Linguist John McWhorter is my guest. His new book is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org. John, what happened to English after the Norman invasion in 1066?
Well, after the Norman invasion, one thing that happened, of course, is a great big bunch of words. And, you know, that story is told in many books, lots of French words, and that was nice. But there was something else that happened, too, and it had actually already been happening, which is that once the Celts started seasoning Old English with their ways of putting words together, and once, in the meantime, the Vikings were beating the language to a pulp because they couldn't learn it completely because they didn't have Berlitz and they didn't need to. All of that was happening, but people were still writing Old English the way it had been when it had been brought over the North Sea, because that's the way writing tended to be in antiquity. It wasn't the way people were speaking out on the ground. It was very codified. It was what I call scripture in the book. But Normans come in, and for about 150 years, depending on how you count it, the language that's written in England is French, and English is just the language spoken by the subjugated, by the peasants. Then, once the Norman relationship begins to change, and native English people start taking over again, you no longer have a situation where the king of England is more comfortable in French than English, then you start getting English written again. And so there's been this 150-year window. The old tradition died. 150 years was a lot longer to a person in antiquity than it is now. No one knew from 150 years ago at this point. So people started writing the language more like it was actually spoken. And so suddenly, one, you've got a big bunch of French words. That's one thing. But then you also have a much simpler grammar and a much more Celtic grammar. And that's something that seems to have been on hold for several centuries while Old English was written in the oldy way. Middle English is a more honest English, and it's a simpler and it's a more mixed language.
So it's not that things changed overnight. The change had been happening.
Yes.
And you point out that people could read Time magazine for 10 years and never hear the phrase whole nother, even though we say it all the time.
Exactly. It's counterintuitive how unlike speech Old English written must have been. But for example, even today, Arabic, modern standard Arabic, is a different language than what a Moroccan speaks while they're in their kitchen. And yet for the Moroccan to see Moroccan Arabic written on the page is unusual. That sort of thing happens more and more in modern times, but still, that's just what you speak. And what you see on the page is something completely different. And in antiquity, many people who spoke what we now know as the Romance languages would never have dreamed of seeing it written. What you wrote and what you read was Latin, and then what you spoke was something different. And it would have been something very similar in England. And we have a little of that now, and so there are all sorts of things that are very commonly said by many people, such as whole nother. I don't think any of us are completely immune to whole nother, that we would never write. If we see it in writing, we chuckle. And the thing is, if our society ended tomorrow and then Martians came and saw evidence of what the English language was like in America in 2008, in terms of writing, they would barely have any way of knowing that anybody ran around saying whole nother. Or things like, and she was like all, and however you feel about it, people do say it. You wouldn't know it from Time magazine. And so that's the situation that we're in trying to get a sense of how people actually talked, which is what was actually happening to the language, as opposed to what people put with quill and ink onto parchment for us to look at now.
Is English a logical language?
Well, no, but then no language is. And so that's something I touch on in the book. If you look at what a language's development really is, how language really changes, and I try to show that with English, then you see that all languages are inevitably going to have their illogicalities and their dents and their dings. And we're often taught that somehow that's wrong, we're supposed to police the language for it, we're supposed to smoke out these things that quote-unquote don't make logical sense and beat people about the head for saying them. But the fact of the matter is that for everything that you beat someone about the head for saying, there's something else in our language that doesn't make any sense that wouldn't bother you at all. And so, for example, I am a 43-year-old man. Amn't I? Shouldn't it be amn't? No, actually, it's aren't, but I would never say I are. Now, who cares about that? That's just the language has a dent in it like most of our cars. But then, when there's something else that someone decides, for about 50 years doesn't make sense, then people write into magazines about it and call into shows and give people a hard time for using the construction, when really there's no language that makes perfect sense. You have to get used to your language as being kind of like your big, messy old chair.
And we should say that you do not subscribe to the belief that the structure of grammar has much to do with the way humans think from one language to the next.
No. However, I do believe that the structure of a phone line has to do with strange noises. I'm going to switch phones right now.
Super. Thank you.
Okay, that noise I think will have gone away. Anyway, no, I don't think that is true the way we're often told. And so there's a hypothesis that our grammars channel our thoughts. And so the idea being that if you put your verb at the end of a sentence, there must be something kind of hesitant about you or something like that. That's a caricature of the view still. And it's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And one point I make in the book is that if that's true, then there ought to be some kind of mental difference between modern English speakers and old English speakers, and specifically, we must be kind of stupid, because in old English, you distinguished objects by gender, you had all sorts of nuances in the grammar. In old English, you had to say, come hither. There's no come here. You said, come hither, like you do in any well-behaved Germanic language. I'm sitting here, but you come hither, and I go thither. That wasn't archaic in old English. That was the way it was. We don't do that. Now, you come here, you sit here, you go there, you sit there. So we don't have that nuance. That doesn't mean that we don't perceive direction as richly as the villager who spoke Old English and never went, you know, beyond 3 miles of their home. And so if we know that, then I think we know that just because Japanese does not mark the future, for example, explicitly, that doesn't mean that the Japanese are not sensitive to what's going to happen in the future to the same degree that we are because we have a word like will. So that whole hypothesis is something that anthropologists and linguists and psychologists have been fascinated by, and there have been some shreds of evidence that in some ways that I think most people would not find terribly dramatic, a grammar can shape the way you are more likely to process something than someone else. But the way it's usually presented, which is, for example, that the Hopi Native American language doesn't mark tense, and therefore the Hopi think of time as cyclical, and they aren't as barbarously linear in their thinking about time as we Westerners. None of that holds up.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Linguist John McWhorter is here. His newest book is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. Let's speak to Gillian in Fort Worth. Hey, Gillian.
Gillian?
Hi, yeah.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Okay, linguistically speaking, my name is Gillian. It goes G-I-L-L-I-A-N, a hard G. Like, I just called, and I said my name is Gillian, and the person who answered the phone said, do you mean Jillian? So I have this problem every day, all the time. Hello, my name is Gillian, and the person says, nice to meet you, Jillian. So I think, linguistically speaking, it should be Gillian, because when we say the gill of a fish, we don't say Jill, but yet when we say giant, we don't say giant. So is my name Gillian as given, or is it Jillian?
It's got to be whatever your mama calls you, I think. But
well, I think basically what I'll say is that if you take a sound like G, there's something that happens in, and I should really say the sound that is indicated in our language by the letter G. That sound, as time goes by, often gets a little bit of what I'll call Y-ness in it. And so Gillian, that would happen over time. So you would say Gillian. Your great-great-grandchild might say Gillian. Now, if you go from G, there's a short distance from G to J. And so a G can become a J. And that's something that we subconsciously feel in our mouths. That's something that happens over time. And then again, of course, there is Jillian. And the star, or minor star, Angillian, I think imprinted in the minds of many people, probably about 30 and older, the idea that that Ilian is supposed to have a J before it. And so it's a statistical thing. I think most of us are more familiar with Jillian than Gillian. I have known, for example, one Gillian in my life and about six Jillians. So unfortunately, I think you are cursed, but I can imagine how that would feel. Nobody calls me Gon.
On the other hand, one of the things that you looked at and puzzled over for a long time was the switch in the sound of P and F in particular words.
Yeah, that was not me that puzzled over it. That is something that happened between that early Proto-Indo-European stage and then Proto-Germanic. So Germanic languages have a quirk. So Latin, pater, for father, and we even have borrowed from that the word paternal. But we don't say pater, we say father. And that's a regular kind of change that you see. What kind of should be a P, based on the great-granddaddy language, becomes an F in Germanic languages. And there are various changes along those lines, including the t and the th. And so it should, we should say pater, and so we say father. And that's just something that happened, and it's one more thing where there are some people who think that it was those Phoenicians. Because what really happened is that crisp sounds that we call stops, like p, became hissy sounds, which we call fricatives, like f. And Semitic languages, like Phoenician, tend to be pretty heavy on the hisses. And so it seems that really Proto-Germanic may have been Proto-Indo-European in a Middle Eastern accent, of all things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to PJ in Arlington. Hi, PJ.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. My comment is, I have to disagree with your author. English is a very logical language. Now, it's not perfect like every other language. I speak Arabic. I was born in Lebanon. I'm one of those descended from those weirdo Phoenicians. But in general, to me, the easiest language to learn as a foreign language when I was trying to learn four different languages, English was the easiest because it made sense. Everything's structured. You have subject, verb, and complement of a sentence. Now, granted, not all words follow order, and you have some exceptions to the rules, but it was very logical. My other comment would be, or question would be, why is it that English, the only language, is the easy to learn, in my opinion, because you have it's subject to change. Every language that refuses to change is a dying language. And I can hang up and take my answer off on the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, it depends on what you mean by logical. Because if you mean simple, then yeah, compared to a lot of languages that you may have learned, English is very simple. Like, for example, in Spanish, to conjugate the verb for to speak, you have hablo, hablas, habla, hablamos, hablais, hablan, and that's I speak, you speak, he, she speaks, and so on. You don't have to deal with any of that. You have that in Arabic, you have that in Spanish. That's not an issue in English where all you have, for example, in the present is the third person, s. And then Arabic, you have to deal with the genders. We don't have that kind of gender. And so simple, yeah, logical, certainly. I personally find Arabic very logical. It's more complicated than English. But then, of course, in Arabic, you get that crazy business with the numbers where genders reverse when you're using the numbers 3 through 10. It's hard to explain on the air. But so every language has its dings in that way. Every language is logical. English is, of course, logical. English is also, as languages go, relatively simple. They're two different things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Randall in Lake Worth writes, I've studied computer programming and ran into an article that talked about the use of English in the European computer programming arena, even in countries that do not primarily speak English. The proposed reason was because English is better suited to describe technical data. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I mean, that's a matter of vocabulary, I imagine. And if there are more words in English to describe certain things like that, because English has been effectively the lingua franca for people working on those things, then naturally, there you go. In terms of the grammar, in terms of English having meaningless do and the ing fetish and the fact that it doesn't put its verbs at the end of the sentence and all the other things that make up what English grammar is, why English would be more appropriate for that than, say, Arabic or Japanese, I couldn't say, but then again, I'm not a computer programmer.
Let's go next to Keith in Dallas. Hello, Keith.
Hello.
Hi, Keith.
Hi. Yeah, John, I just wanted to comment that I really enjoyed your teaching company course on language, which I took about 6 months ago. You have a very definite wit, and it was a thoroughly enjoyable course.
Well, thank you very much.
And my question is, could you comment a little bit on how, I believe I have this correct, English is one of the few languages where double negatives are considered bad. Most languages do not do that. Mm-hmm. And the other comment I have is, are you going to discuss anything on the click languages? Because you seem to be pretty good at that.
Well, on double negatives, yeah, it's interesting. If you look at languages around the world, double negatives as normal is very common. And for so very many people in the world, if you went and told them, when you say, I did not see nothing, it's illogical, would seem a very peculiar kind of school marmish thing to say. The idea that somehow, two negatives make a positive, That is something that has bedeviled English speakers. And the funny thing is that every dialect of English uses double negatives regularly, except the one that happened to become the standard, where you have the rather bizarre construction, I don't see anything. That's a quirk of the dialect that happened to become standard English. And it's interesting. Any other English, if you think about it, the English of Rocky Balboa, the English of hip-hop, the English of one of those kitchen sink British dramas, the way they speak in northern Britain, the English of anywhere, you have people using double negatives and we think of it as wrong. Well, really, how wrong could it be when it's really every kind of English that exists, including Old English, except for modern standard English? And so it's a strange thing. We don't have problem with double negatives in so very many other languages, such as French, but you get smacked about the head for it in English. And as for the click languages, they're lots of fun. I wouldn't say that they are necessarily pertinent to this discussion. It is said that they are probably a reflection of what the first languages in the world were like, and that it's that other languages lost the clicks rather than it being so weird that those languages have them. I don't have the talent for making the clicks. I made the teaching company set several years ago. Now, I imagine I probably faked it, and I'm going to not do it now.
Lots of questions via email about the other Celtic languages, Scottish Gaelic and Irish Gaelic. Can you talk about those?
Yeah. There are two flavors of Celtic. There is one flavor, one branch, which includes Gaelic. Scottish Gaelic and Irish Gaelic are very similar languages. Then there's the other flavor, which is the ones that are native to Britain. And so that's Welsh, Cornish, and Breton, which is spoken over across the Channel. And these languages are all very closely related. There's a big difference between the two branches, though, within Celtic. I'm talking about the Brythonic branch, and that is the ones that are native to Britain. The Gaelic branch is called Goidelic, and they're a different kettle of fish. Similar kettle of fish, but different kettle of fish.
Back in just a minute with John McWhorter. He is a linguist whose new book is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. If you want to join us, we do have one line open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is linguist John McWhorter. His new book is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Azel and speak with Sherry. Hey, Sherry.
Yes. Can you hear?
Yes.
Okay. Heard the information about had been worked into our language.
Phoenician. Mm-hmm.
You aware that the reason that we have 60 minutes and 60 seconds in a minute is also Phoenician?
Did you hear that information,
Tom?
Oh,
yes. I don't think I have that fact in my head. I do now.
We will keep that in mind. And Sherry, is there anything else that we should keep in mind about the Phoenicians?
Well, I was just saying that I taught math for many years, and that was one of the things that we taught was where the minutes and seconds and hours came from.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, the Phoenicians.
You bet. Thank you. Bye-bye.
They were seafarers, and, you know, we'll never know exactly why they were so much more interested in doing it than other cultures, but they did a lot of traveling, they did a lot of trade, and so their language spread further than what you would expect of a language spoken in that particular place at that particular time, and it seems that they probably sailed all the way around Europe, as far up as the little neck that is Denmark, in trade. And so they were quite impressive in that way. And they also gave us the foundation for what is our alphabet. And as far as the arrangement of the clock, that's nice to know as well.
Speaking of traveling, and here's an awkward segue to compare with the one that I made before that was graceful. Where do we get going to indicate future plans? As in, we are going to have a staff meeting tomorrow.
Languages change, and metaphorical interpretations of things set in. That's regularly the way language works. And so if you're going to buy something, then that implies that you are that in the future there will be a buying of it by you. And that's something that you think of so readily when you say she's going to buy it, that or you thought of so regularly before that expression existed, that after a while going to started to mean the futurity instead of the moving. And so around the time that King Charles I was beheaded, and so in the middle of the 1600s, it seems to have become settled in to say, I'm going to read that book, meaning not I'm going to remove myself across the room and pick up that book, but at some point, which is not now, I will be reading that book. That's called grammaticalization, and that's a big, nasty word for just how grammar develops. And that's how we get from point A to point B in a language. Same thing with will. If you want to do something, chances are you are going to do it. And that's how will ended up being another one of our future markers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to David in Addison. Hi, David.
Hi. You just gave me a good segue. Speaking of going to, we've been talking a lot about where our language came from, how it got here, how it got there. Where do you think we're going in the future? Where are some possible trends of where our language could go?
Well, you know, I think that our written language is going to stay more or less the way it is for a very long time. And so there is a cultural tendency to put spoken forms of language, kind of the equivalent of the Celtified English that no one wrote down during Old English times. Nowadays, we write the equivalent of that sort of thing more. And so we at least discuss whole nother in print. Or we write more informally, even in public settings, like with ads and things like that. That sort of thing will continue. But I think that fundamental change is something that happens more quickly in a language when it isn't written, when there isn't a standard that people look to as the way the language, quote-unquote, should be. Now, I think English is going to become more widespread. We have 6,000 languages now. Chances are we'll have more like 500 or 600 in about 100 years that are actually spoken. More people will speak English. They'll speak it in all sorts of different flavors because the languages that they speak natively are going to color the way they render English, so there'll be many more Englishes. But I think that English is a kind of a kudzu language, and I'm not sure we can do anything about that, nor will Mandarin Chinese be a realistic competitor for various reasons. But English itself, I would say that if we look upon it in 500 years, it's going to be much more similar to what English is now than our English now is to English from 500 years before.
Is there reason to believe that all the world's languages will be more like each other based on the sharing of words as time goes by?
In terms of sharing of words, yeah, and sometimes even in terms of sharing of grammar, because when languages mix in one mouth, they tend to become more like one another, and there are all sorts of reasons why one, the dominant language or the subordinate language may have more of an effect. But yeah, there will be that loss of genetic diversity, so to speak. The analogy of them in language will definitely be happening.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying your guest today. It's one of my favorite subjects. And I wanted to ask why he thinks English is so influenced by Latin, even though it's considered a Germanic language. I studied German, and I've worked there extensively, and there are just a lot more Latin derivations in English, really over almost 50% of the language than you find in German, which supposedly supplies our grammar of English. Do you think it was the early Roman colonization of Britain or the Norman invasions? Why do you think English seems so influenced by Latin?
Well, you know, there are many ways of answering the question, and I'm not sure that there's a conclusive reason why English has a particularly heavy overlay, although that Latin influence is very robust in other European languages. There was a time when, of course, Latin was the scholarly and even literary lingua franca of Europe, and so if you put anything on the page, whatever you spoke to your spouse, you wrote in Latin, and that continued, you know, well into what we would even consider modern times, 1600s, even 1700s. And so Latin made its way into English
in large part not because of that earlier Roman occupation. You'd think it would, and it's almost mysterious why it had so little effect. What it really was through writing. And so people who were trying to develop English into what they thought of as a legitimate world language, which English was not always. It's really just some language that arose on a windy little island among pre-literate, largely pre-literate people. It could have just stayed that way. But instead, there was a time when people thought this language needs to be expanded. It needs to have a larger vocabulary. And that was particularly after the Norman invasion. And this started happening really quickly during the Renaissance. And so lots of Latin words were consciously brought in. There were people who saw it as their duty to do that, just like there were people who saw it as their duty to bring German and French words into Russian to serve similar purposes, as well as Latin ones. But yeah, that happened quite a bit with English, and it was largely a matter of things making it from the page into people's mouths. That's also the way most of our French vocabulary made it into our current mouths right now.
How much was the influence of Latin a product of the influence of the Catholic Church?
That was a large part of it, of course, because the Catholic Church's business was conducted in Latin, and in a time when religion was much more central to most people's existences than it is now to the descendants of those people in England, that would have had a lot to do with the language taking on more Latin words, even on a casual level. These are things which, you know, there was no YouTube, people weren't writing these things down, and so a lot of it has to be guessed. No one can tell us, here's why we use the word assist instead of help. But we can reconstruct that this was the process, the kind of process that created it.
Are you envious of the linguists that will do their work 1,000 years from now and ostensibly have technological evidence of the way we had spoken speech as well as written speech?
You know what? I'm going to give a quirky answer to that. No, because, yeah, the linguists of the future are going to be able to look at this stuff happening practically day by day, and people are going to be talking about it. It's going to be so much messier, and then in a way, easier. Whereas I must admit that there's a part of me that enjoys the detective work, you know, there being a kind of an antiquarian aspect to me. The frustration is that you can never make an absolute smoking gun case because there are always going to be other ways of looking at things. Although I think when it comes to Celtic, there's no reason to suppose that Celtic was not central. Nevertheless, it's a matter of piecing together evidence from a lot of places and always having to say, after a certain point, no one will ever be able to tell us. That will not be a problem for people later, but that means they'll be involved in something much different. They'll be gathering, whereas what I'm doing involves a kind of a fun guesswork, detective work, Sherlock Holmes. I must admit, I kind of enjoy this, although the people in the future will be luckier in that they can make an absolutely conclusive kind of case that we people these days will never be able to do.
Well, it shows that you enjoy it, and that's a good thing.
Hope so.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, I've got a couple of questions.
Give us one, Ed, because we've got lots of people on the line.
Okay. I've come across an article or two recently that said the upshots of which were that the DNA analysis that's being done of the spread of people around the world doesn't match the linguistic analysis that's being done, and I wondered if you experienced that controversy and what you thought about it.
Thanks for your call.
There are cases where we can't be quite sure why the language and the DNA don't match, but by and large, actually, language and DNA do match quite beautifully. The work of Luca Cavalli-Sforza, and then nowadays work by Spencer Wells in terms of what's making it more into the popular realm, are showing that DNA traits and mitochondrial DNA and what's on the Y chromosome track pretty well with what languages are or have been spoken and where. And it's even at the point where we can see pretty much how many Anglo-Saxons and Jutes came to England and how many Celts died. And the DNA does get confusing here and there. But by and large, there has been a good friendship between geneticists and historical linguists in terms of why human beings are where they are in the world.
Let's speak next to Randy in Fort Worth. Hello, Randy.
Hi, I'm wondering if I'm the only person who's noticed that all of these phrases that seem to creep into the English language in America anyway, that don't seem to really have any meaning or they don't add anything. And I'm thinking specifically of the phrase on the ground. It seems like everybody says everything's happening on the ground. Our reporter in Iraq on the ground. That really doesn't add anything. I mean, Does that mean as opposed to floating above it? Or and then we have new phrases like at the end of the day. You know, we used to say the bottom line, and using impact as a verb instead of saying effect. And I'm just wondering, does anybody else notice this? And what causes it? I mean, what causes language to evolve or phrases to become popular that don't really add anything new to the conversation?
Well, this is the sort of thing that happens in all languages, actually. And it depends on what you call adding. And so it may not be that the words are being used in their literal meaning, but it's natural to language that words end up not being in. So just like going to, somebody might have said in about 1600, what do you mean you're going to read it when you're not even going to get up out of the chair? You know, why are you saying that? And it's because the language changes in terms of how people lend these abstract meanings. On the ground is something, I use that expression all the time, is something to indicate that something is happening out in the real world among ordinary people rather than something happening, say, in the ivory tower or among the journalistic chattering classes. Similarly, people talk about out there, you know, how people are going to vote for Barack Obama out there, to give a memorable phrase that was pertinent before about a month ago. And then as far as at the end of the day, that is for drama. I use that one too. And so when you're making a point, when you say, well, at the end of the day, i.e. everybody's having a cocktail and the sun's going down and we can all kind of take a second breath and reconsider, it is clear that, boom. And so no day has ended, but you're using it in a metaphorical way because we human beings think that way on all levels. So no language is completely literal, and if it were, it would be a rather Martian affair.
You know, I find it interesting, John, that you are among several linguists that we've had on this show who tend to be the least snobby about the use of the language as compared with a lot of other people who consider themselves to be experts about it.
Yeah, it's part of being a linguist, and it's not ideological. It comes partly from the fact that if you have had occasion to examine the grammars of a wide range of languages, you realize that all languages are such messes that the notion that there's something wrong with the aspects of English that don't make strict military sense, it just doesn't cohere. You know, you couldn't spray for mistakes and get rid of all the odd little ripples in languages around the world. So yeah, people speak, and what's interesting to a linguist is that, well, at least to this linguist, is that you can see someone laying on the ground. It's at the end of a party, and they've drunk too much, and you know their clothes are all astray, and they're a complete mess, and yet they still are speaking the language that is native to them, using all the complexities, all the irregular verbs. Russian is a language that's so hard that I don't really believe anybody actually speaks it. I'm kidding. But if a Russian person were in the position that I actually described, no matter how much of a mess they are still conjugating the verbs, declining the nouns effortlessly. That is a marvel. Then someone comes along and says, I don't like it that you're using the word structure as a verb. Somehow, one has a hard time paying attention.
John McWhorter is a linguist and also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. His newest book is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. John, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us again.
That was a great interview. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.